It's been called the most popular game in schools around the world. And this weekend, over $30 million in prize money was given out for playing it. Yes, this week on Download This Show, Fortnite. How the hell did a cartoony battle royale game become such big business? Plus, can you legislate against social media addiction? And which Australian state is best for aspiring gaming and technology companies? Is it New South Wales? WA? South Australia? Yeah, let's find it out. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed. It is a brand new episode of Download This Show, and I'm going to start the show with an apology. We did have another guest that had to pull out at the last minute, but the good news is we have the triumphant return of Seamus Byrne from the Biteside Podcast Network. It's been far too long.
And it's going to be all about me today. So it's really, you get it like a double dose in one episode, apparently.
Well, you're going to tell us how to make our children into millionaires on the game Fortnite is the promise of this episode.
Right. Congratulations, everybody. Get ready next year. You're going to be the one that wins.
Amazing. So you've just gotten back from New York. You're at the Fortnite World Cup. Now, before we get into the specific details of how I monetize my children, might just get you to start off and talk about why Fortnite as a game has become such a juggernaut. Fortnite has been called the most popular video game in schools, but actually, for somebody that's never played it before, what is Fortnite?
Yeah. The easiest reference is Hunger Games. So it's that idea that, you know, it's called a battle royale style of game. 100 people get dropped onto an island, literally. And I mean, it's such a cartoonish, crazy game, right? Everybody jumps off a bus that is floating above this island on a giant balloon. And then you just jump out, you land somewhere, and then you have to start kind of finding items and you start like harvesting wood and bricks and things so you can also build in the game.
It's also the ABC's cadet program for young journalists, as I recall. Very similar. What happens at the Fortnite World Cup? Because we've been seeing headlines about people walking away with millions of dollars. I think in excess of $30 million that was made in prize money over the weekend.
Yeah, in terms of the entire weekend, yeah, about $36 million US dollars. So more than $50 million Aussie dollars.
So what actually happened?
Yeah, so over the last like 10 weeks, there was the whole build up to it. So all this online qualification process, 40 million players actually participated in that, trying to kind of win one of 200 slots, basically. They had a solo competition, which was, you know, 100, one versus one, well, one versus 100, one versus 99. That's probably the right way to do it.
I mean, I feel the math stacks up better that way.
Something like that. And then a duos competition, so 50 pairs of people also kind of fighting it out. And on the weekend, that's where all the sort of the final event happened in New York. Apparently, you know, they sold about 19,000 tickets to the event overall. And the event's kind of production qualities were really kind of through the roof. And I think one of the big parts of the game is that it's evolved so carefully and it's kept just kind of tweaking its format. And particularly as a competitive spectacle, it's really kind of hard to watch because unlike two teams fighting each other, this is 100 separate people. And the camera work within a video game to try to work out which moment of what's happening is worth showing on camera has been quite tricky, but they've started to get that working really well.
When you say the evolution of the game, is that what you're talking about, or are there more sort of elements within it that have evolved in the 2 years that it's been around?
Yeah, so look, I mean, even things like the map itself, it's always been this one island, but they have every sort of couple of months, they make changes to that island to kind of keep things changing, keep it fresh. They keep changing what kinds of, you know, items and weapons and things you can kind of discover in the game, right through to the point. And again, the cartoonish qualities can't be, you know, overstated, because for ages early on, people were sort of saying, oh, this game needs vehicles. You know, it's too slow to move around. It really needs to introduce vehicles. And the first vehicle that they introduced was a shopping trolley. And literally, it's like one person could jump in the trolley and another person could push the trolley.
So it had an inbuilt social component to it then, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think this is really fascinating. So I do want to get into why the game has proven to be so popular, but it does strike me as you're talking that there is an archetype that it's playing into that has existed for many, many years. Group of kids,
locked on a secure environment. So obviously you've got Lord of the Flies, you've got the original Japanese film Battle Royale, which I think is probably quite
the whole genre name comes from.
Pretty much. And then of course, who can forget old Hunger Games? So is it that it feeds into a well-worn and very attractive archetype, or is there something else that you think has contributed to its massive success?
Yeah, I think there is a lot to be said for the fact that when it launched, it captured a lot of teenagers who were starting to age out of Minecraft. You know, that there was that era where people had played this game, which was a building game, and people had kind of added modes into Minecraft where you could kind of have combat and different things and do some of that social stuff. And this was a game that took what was actually at that stage, there was another game called PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds that was the biggest thing in this battle royale genre. But it was, you know, very sort of intense, you know, Call of Duty style kind of realistic action type game. And then Epic came along and made this, again, this cartoon-friendly version that it had all these building aspects to it as well, so that, you know, it just made it this much more approachable style for these, again, these younger teens who were sort of looking for something that was a bit more substantial. And then A, it was free to play, and B, it was a solid, serious action game in a way that I think a lot of, particularly when it then arrived on mobile, that's when it really sort of, you know, completely blew up. And within sort of about 6 weeks, I think it went from like 40 million players to over 100 million players. And that was the sort of moment where, you know, free on mobile and a genuine game was that sort of trifecta that meant it just went through the roof.
Yeah, right. Obviously, I can appreciate where the money is made in terms of a big World Cup, this prize money. But for professional gamers, particularly in this space, right, and this is going to sound really dumb to lots of gamers, and I will confess I'm a gaming noob. How does one make money from being a Fortnite player?
Yeah. So, number one, most of the biggest players in the world, they make money just by streaming on Twitch, basically. So, that means they play online, but they're also able to kind of have that conversation with their real-time audience. Mm. They're watching chat.
Twitch is it's a streaming platform. If you're gaming, other people can tune in and watch on.
Yeah, it's like a platform with, you know, millions of channels. Where anybody can just start live streaming what's going on, you know, their game machine. And there is a real skill to that ability to, you know, read comments people are leaving for you while you're also trying to play a game at quite a high level.
Multitasking, you say. Interesting.
Yes. And that kind of means when people are able to build that community that supports them in that way. And Twitch has a subscription system so that if you're above a certain threshold of followers, they will make you a partner of the network, which means you basically get a split on every subscriber's revenue. You know, if you've got a few thousand subscribers and you're getting, you know, a couple of dollars per subscriber, that's a solid income.
So let's fast forward for me. Fortnite has been a huge, massive success. It's had a huge cut through. It's having a cultural moment. Does it last? Because, I mean, you said something really interesting that stuck with me, which is the notion that it picked up people who were aging out of Minecraft, which was the fun, creative block game that is beloved by every child I know. What does its future look like if its current audience ages out? Will it pick up new ones, or will it expand and grow with them, a la Harry Potter?
Yeah. So look, I think it's doing a great job of kind of growing up with its audience. And there are still, you know, there are plenty of 20-somethings, 30-somethings who play the game too. It is interesting that in the wider esports community, there is a real disdain for Fortnite. They really do kind of try to, it's not a proper esport, man, because it doesn't have, like, it's not teams and it's not this and it's not that. And it's crazy because it's like, wow, on one hand, these people desperately want esports to be better recognized in the mainstream. And then when one is, they're like, but that's not a proper esport.
Maybe it's because I come from slightly outside the gaming world.
Yeah.
And I believe esports requires incredible skill and mental tenacity. The notion of calling one thing a proper one and the other thing a not proper one still seems a little bit like the pot calling kettle black to me, just quietly.
Yeah. Look, when it comes to that idea of how it's evolving, what is fascinating is that Epic Games, I think, has been leveraging the success in some really smart ways. You know, one is that they've actually kind of added a very Minecraft-style component to the game. They've added this whole creative element, which means every person can now basically have their own personal version of the island. They can build things. They can invite their friends to visit their island. And the founder of Epic Games, Tim Sweeney, is really quite openly talking about the idea that he sees Fortnite as becoming a platform rather than just a game. And it's something that he has these ambitions to kind of essentially use it as like the foundation for really big metaverse type discussions on, you know, essentially creating a true shared virtual online community space that is about socialization as much as it's about anything else. He's genuinely starting to talk about things like opening it up in ways that tries to kind of make it an open standard for other people to build upon rather than just treating it as sort of a closed game.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. We are in studio with Seamus Byrne from the Bite Side Podcast Network. We normally have two panelists, but one of our other panelists, she had to pull out at the very last minute. My name is Mark Fennell, and this is the show where we examine the week in media, technology, and culture. And how addictive do you think social media is? Well, a senator in the United States by the name of Josh Hawley has introduced something called the Social Media Addiction Reduction Technology Act, or SMART Act.
Got it. So clever.
It's like when you're arranging the words just so you can get an acronym, but actually if you say them out loud, Social Media Addiction Reduction Technology, it actually doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But it has been regarded as a bill that could make social media, that could limit the addictive qualities of social media. And I mean, we're talking about something, legislation that's in the US, but let's be honest, if it has an impact in the US, it'll probably have a knock-on effect for the rest of us, Samus.
Yeah, so look, I mean, the kinds of things that they're talking about trying to limit is the sorts of features that make it easy to just basically never close social media.
Yep, I've got all of the major tabs open right now. I've got my Twitter, my Instagram, I don't know why I've got Instagram open, Facebook. So am I the problem?
You are the problem, Mark.
I mean, I've been the problem.
There we go. We've solved it. You are the problem.
The act will ban Mark.
Yeah.
Fair call.
I mean, you know, I think one of the interesting examples that jumps out at me is he specifically flags things like infinite scrolling as being one of those things that is a problem. You know,
yes.
The fact that you don't get to the bottom of a page. And there was no question that in the earlier days of the internet, that it was just something that web pages couldn't easily do, was dynamically add more content if you got to the bottom.
Yeah.
You know? And that's something that social media now does so that there is no end of the road.
I didn't probably take notice of it when that technology came in. If you're wondering what we're talking about, there are countless websites, particularly news sites across the internet, where you scroll to the bottom of an article. It just looks like another article starts then, and you keep on going. You read that one, you go to the next one, and before you know it, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're wondering what you did with your life. So are there other components to it that can tackle things like screen time? Because we've seen actually Apple being quite on the front foot about this, about giving you tools to measure your screen time and also changing colors of the screen to kind of help you, you know, gear down. That's not a phrase, but let's imagine that it is at the end of the day.
Dark mode type things,
yeah.
Which there isn't necessarily much evidence for it actually having an impact, but it feels nice. It does kind of feel nice. I like it.
Look at you with your desperate desire for scientific evidence. What is this? A technology program?
One of the things that I think is really valid about sort of this whole discussion is the idea that there's a thing that gets referred to by user interface designers as dark patterns. And that is a very kind of real aspect to the fact that there are real tricks that UI, as it gets called, UI designers can use to keep someone clicking things or to keep people feeling like it's not easy to leave, you know, what's going on. And I think within, you know, some of this sort of context, as much as I'm, you know, scared of the idea that, oh, well, somehow you can, you know, ban companies from disseminating information in certain ways, I think there are kind of real aspects to, like, say, opt-in type buttons and things that do come up on social media a lot, that they are being very carefully designed to basically keep us clicking the thing that says, yes, I want to let you do whatever you like with my information, or yes, please sign me up for the next thing that keeps sending me messages so that I always get told to come back as often as possible. And those kinds of things have, I think, very real dangers attached to them.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. Seamus Byrne is here in studio with us. And is Adelaide the hottest place in Australia right now if you want to develop games, virtual reality, AR? Well, that is the argument put forward by Dan Thorsland. He works for the gaming company Mighty Kingdom, which is based in Adelaide. Dan's had a fascinating career. He's American, as you're about to hear. He relocated to Adelaide in 2001. He's worked on not just games, but also he edited comic books for many years. He was an editor of Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman, as well as developing Star Wars properties as well. But he chooses to make his home in Adelaide because he argues that it's one of the best places in the country right now if you want to develop, well, nerdy things. Dan joins us now. Dan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
So you've worked in creative industries for a very, very long time in quite a few different places. But what I find fascinating about you is that you mount the argument that I haven't heard before, that Adelaide is a hotspot for video game development. Now, for somebody that does not live in Adelaide, what is it about Adelaide that makes it so special?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. There is quite a few generations of people here that are very serious about creative industries. And it goes all back to the Dunstan era when he said, you know, festivals, art, and culture is a really significant part of this sweet little community here. And for folks, you know, from interstate and particularly for overseas, if they don't come to Adelaide, they don't realize that that's a really intrinsic part of what Adelaide is. So when I stepped off the plane in 2001, one of the first guys I worked with was a great digital artist. He could TIG weld, and he was a certified public accountant. And that, to me, kind of typified what is awesome about the development scene here in South Australia. The artists are great. They care about their art. They have a lot of venues and places to show it. They have a very strong dialogue and culture of creating great art and great creative. But they're also technically quite adept, and they don't assume they're going to make a lot of money in their life. So they learn to be very, very, very functional generalists. And that's what the video game industry needed, certainly in the early 2000s, to feed it. So you had a lot of people that would rotate out of defense who learned how to program and do simulations and stuff. But underneath it all, they wanted to be storytellers. Mm. They wanted to do cool stuff. They wanted to do things that weren't about targeting systems. They wanted to tell stories and change the world. And I think that has matured and incubated over the past 20 years that I've been here to become what I think is by far the country's coolest development community for video games.
And also, if you're going to build targeting systems, build them to kill zombies in a game.
It's exactly. That's such a transferable skill.
Across the different video game specifically companies that you've worked at, how much has the industry changed since you started working in it?
Oh, vastly. So in 2001, I think there was a little study that was done when Microsoft first hooked up Xbox Live so they could actually kind of monitor. I think it was at the 360 at the time, so it was later than 2001. But they were starting to look at how many people actually completed the games that they started because they had installed all these achievement systems within video games in order to harvest data off of users. But it was a cool thing, and people could share their achievements around. And they realized, wow, like 80% of the stuff that people are picking up on the shelf and whacking in their console, they never actually finished the game. And we thought, we're wasting a huge amount of money on building content that people don't care about. So that was one significant part of the industry, that it was just over-investing in the amount of content being created, and it was all done at a $50 price point. And then the second thing was obviously the GFC. So the GFC made a massive, massive change, especially to the Australian economy in terms of what kind of video games are being made here. So for a long time, we were a great place to put production because the AU dollar was cheap, but we were good practitioners. There were a lot of really good and effective studios and game developers in Australia. It was 65 cents to the US dollar. But as soon as that went up to parity and a little bit above, the industry collapsed. They closed all the studios and they shipped the work elsewhere. So we were almost forced as a community with this extraordinary skill and this really good reputation for making great games to make games that people actually wanted to play and would play all the way through at 100%. So long story short, Apple's iPhone comes along. Hobbyist and independent development becomes something that you can actually make some money out of. And folks like Firemint in Melbourne and Halfbrick up in Brisbane were doing, you know, downloadable mobile games that were making money. You know, the advent of mobile gaming and free-to-play mobile in particular created a whole different business economy that was much easier for small practitioners to get into. And that really, really suited Australia. So now if you look at the global economics in video games, half of that $200 billion AU a year that gets gobbled up by consumers playing games, half of that is mobile games. So that whole industry really didn't exist 10 years ago.
If you want to make a feature film in this country, no one's suggesting it's easy, but there are array of funding bodies that you can go to. How does the game industry compare to access to funding that if you, when you sit it next to the film industry?
We don't have it, you know, and it's been the case for as long as I've been here. So if you look at the screen industry bodies, and I use the term screen industry lightly, you know, in South Australia, it's specifically called the South Australian Film Corporation, they tend to be very centric towards linear narrative. The video game industry has tried unsuccessfully for a long, long, long time to lobby both the federal and state governments to find ways to integrate practitioner support with screen organization bodies. But there is a huge generational issue in terms of how the video game industry operates and how traditional film commissions operate, as you'd imagine. You know, how you go to a festival or you get a piece in Sundance, how many crew you employ, all of that stuff kind of wraps around the film industry and has a certain amount of prestige and it has a certain amount of cultural relevance that politicians and most people that work in government kind of can understand. And it's a 100-year-old plus production environment. So how you actually make film, even though it's all digital now. I went to film school when I had to cut stuff on celluloid. You know, that's how old I am. You know, it hasn't really changed that much in terms of what a scriptwriter does and what a director does and, you know, what a, you know, DOP does and all the different production processes. It hasn't changed that significantly in terms of those roles. So long story short, the video game industry just is this constantly evolving and despite its enormous interest in a certain generation of Australians and its ability to earn money, it just doesn't fit the traditional guidelines of these organizations. So it has never been able to find that kind of support. So we don't have it. In film, in Victoria, it's a little different. So Film Vic, when the Abbott government got in and cut the one dedicated funding stream for video games that Simon Crean set up, you know, it's the first thing Hockey did was whack it. The Film Vic kind of took some of that over. And they actually incubated some very successful projects. So Crossy Road came out of that funding stream that Film Vic was doing. But they took the money, I think, from the innovation sector. I don't think they took it directly from film. So there has been little examples of how it's worked. But for the most part, consistently, these organizations don't interact with the video game industry at all. If you don't seed fund these activities and then find a way to take the successful activity and pathway it into something that has a commercial outcome, we starve. The stuff just doesn't really work. The reason the video game industry has been able to get past that, despite the fact that, you know, they've never had that kind of support, is that accessibility of the mobile game market. That's really, really important. So it costs you about $150 a year to get a license to put software in the App Store. And in the early days of the App Store, no one really had an expectation as to what a video game even was that you played on an iPhone. So it could be simple, like Fruit Ninja, you know, just swiping back and forth and cutting fruit. So the scale of those are really tiny. And the expectation from consumers was like, I'm having fun, I'll pay for it. And I think it was like, you know, 99 cents, $2 a pop for Fruit Ninja. So we've, in a lot of ways, our success and our agility as an industry to find new revenue models for production has meant that the traditional organizations just ignore us because we don't seem to need their help. But we do. We do. We really do. We really do. We can't scale like other regions around the globe have until we get that help from those organizations.
It's an interesting challenge, though, isn't it? Because I guess there's also a continuing conversation around, you know, some of the success of the gaming industry is that there's more opportunities within a game to monetize a game. Mm. You know, a feature film, once you put your ticket, it's done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or even with a television series, like you punch the ticket by selling it to a streaming company or a broadcaster, and then you can maybe sell it in a few other markets, but then that's it. Whereas games, not all of them, granted, but a lot of games have different opportunities to generate revenue from within the games as well.
Correct.
And that's obviously the subject of debate as well. Do you think the fact that games have mechanisms or potential mechanisms within them to generate more money is what's standing in the way of gaming as an industry getting more governmental support?
Possibly. I think sometimes there's a view that the way in which money is generated within a game could be seen as a negative. It cheapens the experience and it doesn't have a significant cultural output. So I think it often will come back to that. So the two things that the games industry does successfully that the film industry doesn't do is exactly what you said, is it finds ways to make money itself directly from a consumer in a global market through either microtransactions within a game or just selling the game for $3 a pop, you know, as a premium product, or 15 if you're on a console. So that's one way, and that those games persist within a library that's more effective than what Apple has been able to do with iTunes, which is why iTunes is getting shut down. People don't want to go back and pay for something as a one-off. They just want it as part of a subscription piece of content. So that's part of the issue. But I think the other part of the issue is just pure snobbery. Like, games aren't real. They're not serious. They aren't a part of our culture. They don't represent our voice. They don't have genuine narrative and emotion built into them. They're trivial, you know. And I think that is a big, big, big issue that we have, where there's a great generational bias in a certain age of folks in Australia, which is my age, really, where they just don't take games as a serious, relevant cultural piece. And in fact, they think it might be negative and create negative behavior. So I think that those two components are the big issue.
You could say the same thing about Aquaman, right? And yet governments have no trouble putting money or favorable tax situations in place in order to make sure that an Aquaman blockbuster gets made in the state of Queensland. So this some inconsistencies, I think, in the way that sort of that cultural attitude gets applied.
And I think an Aquaman may come in and get a lot of food trucks and key grips and hotels booked, but it'll be a peak of, what, 6 months, depending on how long principal photography is, right? So it's easy for people, on the one hand, to look at that production and say film production means a lot to the economy. But on the other hand, you know, the games industry will point to that and say, but it's very cyclical and it peaks and valleys really quickly. Whereas the games industry, when a game hits, we persist that employment.
Dan Thorsland, you are an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today.
No problem at all. Thank you, Mark.
That was Dan. Dan was speaking at the Screenmakers Conference in Adelaide, and we are back in studio here with Seamus Byrne. It's a bit of a fight at the moment for where's the best place to develop games in Australia, because, I mean, there's fantastic investments in both Victoria and Queensland as well, isn't there?
Yeah, it's great to see a lot of these efforts from state governments to kind of, you know, fill a void that's been there. I think the games industry has always... it hasn't been asking for more than the film industry. That's been their big target. It's just to say, can you just fund us in the way that you kind of look after our local filmmakers, because we actually now make more money than they do anyway. But it would help to kind of lift up the, you know, the ability of independent makers to sort of do more with what they have. And I think definitely a lot of things I've been hearing do say that, you know, Adelaide is pushing hard, and particularly Victoria's probably been the leader. But there's now a good competition going on pretty much everywhere except New South Wales.
Yeah, I knew you were about to say, except New South Wales, which is definitely not the state that I happen to broadcast from. Hey, with that, thank you very much for holding the fort down, Seamus Byrne.
Welcome.
If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review. Hopefully we'll be back to having two panelists next week. My name's Finn Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.